Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
This episode of Inciting a Riot is brought to you by SpeakYourOwnBook.com. Do you want to write a book but have no idea where to start? Let their team of talented writing coaches, editors, project managers, and transcribers assist you every step of the way. Or are you a podcaster or done a lot of interviews? Have you already spoken your book out loud and just need to put it to text? Let their book writing transcription experts take it from there. They also offer a host of other services for vocal authors. Check them out at speakyourownbook.com.
Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for Inciting a Riot. Conventional thinking has been warned. We're gonna gather, and we're gonna march, and we're gonna blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing, dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, episode 172 is Inciting a Pilgrim Riot. No, it's not about Thanksgiving here in the United States. It's not about corn. It's about spiritual pilgrimage. You know, almost everyone at some point looks around at their lives and asks why. We wonder why our family believes in the politics that we do, or we eat the food that we eat. You know, we, the people that we grew up with. We also wonder about where our beliefs come from. Oftentimes, those questions and the subsequent journey afterwards lead people to interact with our community, the magical community. But what if you're already here? What if you're already part of this magical community? What then? What if you were raised in a magical household? Where do your questions take you? To other religions? Back up the food chain of evolution to where the spiritual beliefs came from? That's what happened for Dr. Eric Scott, who is my guest today. He's the co-editor for The Wild Hunt, a researcher on the subject of spiritual pilgrimage, and has the unique quality of having been raised by witches. He did what many of us do. He looked around at his magical existence and asked where it all came from and whether it all fits his worldview. And then he set out to find those answers. In my interview with Dr. Scott today, I was really excited because I got to talk to someone with a perspective that I don't have, that almost nobody on the planet has. Somebody who was actually raised, born and raised inside of this community and spent their entire lives here, got to see the evolution of the pagan community firsthand from the front row. So I'm really, really, really excited to have that discussion today. But I did want to talk about something really quick. I've noticed in the last couple of weeks that there has been little spots of discourse that seem to consume social media all at once for days on end and get turned into these big wild stories. And I know that that's how social media works. I'm not dumb. And I have certainly been known in the 12 years that I have been doing Inciting a Riot to have been part of some of that discourse and social media upheaval. But I kind of want to drill down into some of the things that have come up, because I want you all to ask better questions. When you see a claim being made, I want to equip you with, you know, I want to give you the permission slip so that you know that it's okay to ask why before you join into a given conversation. One of the conversations that I have seen in recent weeks is that there is some mass cancellation of Llewellyn publications. And when you dig into that, it seems like It all stemmed from a single comment underneath a very influential pagan influencer's comment section. That was a comment from one of their comment sections saying that, you know, oh, you read Llewellyn books. That's terrible. You know, we don't do that anymore. And I'm sure that that's representative of some kind of, you know, to use a to use an archaic term, some kind of scuttlebutt that's happening offline or elsewhere. But it doesn't seem to have been indicative of any kind of conversation that was happening where other people could see it. There weren't like blogs that had been leading up to some great discourse that we were canceling Llewellyn as a publisher on the whole. It's not how it happened. There was a single comment made in an influencer's comment section. That influencer then commented on the comment, and suddenly, because of the size of the influencer's reach, now it's discourse. Now it's everywhere. Suddenly we're all talking, oh, why are we canceling a publisher? Nobody's canceling a publisher. Nobody's canceling Llewellyn. I mean, I've been as critical of Llewellyn as anyone. And the only thing that I think I could ever say is I just want our publishers to do better and be more accountable for their publishing processes, for how they select the books and authors they do, and how they vet the information that goes out in the world. But I certainly don't want to cancel anyone. I certainly don't think that we need to cancel our pagan publishers. If anything, we need to support them. We need to make sure that they have the funding and resources they need to grow with the changing times, to be better, to be the publishers we want them to be. But nobody's canceling anything. Something else that has come up in discourse in recent days is that allegedly Disney owns Loki. Apparently, everybody is like freaking out, utterly freaking out. The Wild Hunt did an article talking about how there's petitions going around to get Disney to stop, I don't know, owning the term Loki, saying that, you know, Disney's trying to trademark, Disney's trying to copyright Norse gods, and they're going to take legal action against you for worshiping the deities of your understanding. And I'm so sorry to say that while that makes a really fun story because we do all like being victims, that is not happening at all, like even a little bit. Where all of this stemmed from was a single human being that has a Redbubble shop. Redbubble, I have a Redbubble shop. Redbubble is a website where you can upload your art and it gets turned into T-shirts and mugs and all sorts of stuff, and the artist gets a tiny little bit of commission, you know, art commission, but they don't have to put up the money to, you know, have pre-printed T-shirts and mugs and notebooks and things like that. It's great. It's a cool thing, and it, you know, low overhead provides authors a good service. However, because of the kind of website that it is, where you can just pretty much upload stuff and it becomes things, and then you make money off of that. There are a lot of people that take advantage of those kinds of websites, and they will upload artwork and images and ideas that do not belong to them and make as much money as they possibly can and then disappear into the ether when inevitably the shop gets taken down. In this case, you know, as you all probably know, the Disney Plus show Loki is out right now. And Loki has been a Marvel character, a character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe for the better part of a decade. Well, because of that, Redbubble it apparently took down temporarily a piece of art from a single shop that said Loki on it. Now, I have had things taken down on Redbubble before. I've posted up artwork of wizards and posted up artwork of witches and things like that. And I've had it taken down because in the tags, so you can tag the artwork so that it appears in related searches. If you put, like, if you're uploading a wizard and you think, well, maybe people that are searching for Harry Potter might want, you know, to see some wizard artwork or something like that. You know, if you put Harry Potter in the tags, even if the art isn't about Harry Potter, even if you're not calling the wizard illustration itself anything having to do with the Harry Potter universe, the fact that it's tagged Harry Potter means it's probably going to get taken down if it's not officially licensed work. I have no idea if that happened here. I don't know if it was maybe just a little itchy trigger finger on the part of Redbubble. Redbubble's known to do stuff like that. I do know that the art was almost immediately put back up and that the artist now has quite a lot of visibility that they got for, you know, being the victim of Disney. Disney didn't do this. Redbubble did this. Redbubble did this so that they don't possibly get sued by places like Disney. But Redbubble does this for all sorts of things, for like Rick and Morty and you know, Pokemon and all sorts of other, you know, big, huge properties, intellectual properties. So the story here isn't that Disney is trying to copyright Loki and is, you know, pressing charges, is filing lawsuits against small independent artists if they try to use the name Loki on their art that honors the actual Norse god Loki. The story here is that Redbubble made an algorithm mistake and it was quickly corrected. But that's not as much fun as a big corporation is targeting pagans. That's not as much fun. We don't get to be victims then, if that's the story. And gosh, boy, howdy, do people love nothing more than to get to be the victim. Now, there is a case to be made that there is an ever-encroaching issue surrounding who gets to own what kind of things. How do artists get to express themselves? Can you ever make fan art? Can you ever sell it? Can you ever post it on social media? Those are conversations that we can have. But what we're not going to do is suddenly act like there's discourse about Disney trying to own all of Norse paganism, because that's not happening. So what I would like to invite you all to do is, when it seems like suddenly everyone everywhere is talking about a thing, before you say, you know, before you jump on your social media bandwagon and say, yeah, F you, Disney, how dare you try to own Loki, like, dig just a tiny bit deeper. Go try to find a firsthand account. Figure out where that came from. And maybe realize that there's more to the story, or that there's not even a story there. Ask why. Asking why is always the most valuable question that you can ask. Why would Disney try to own all of Norse paganism? And the thing is, Disney can't own. They cannot own the concept of Loki. What they can own is the image of Loki that they have created for the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and any updates to that image that they create. This is by no means the first time that Disney has created images of mythological figures to you know, for fun and profit. Hercules comes to mind, you know, Darby O'Shea and the Little People. I mean, gosh, you know, there are so many instances of is it Darby O'Shea? Darby O'Gill? Oh gosh, the people that are going to write in correcting me about that old Sean Connery movie. I'm sorry, I don't remember. I know it's on Disney Plus and I watched it last year. Anyways, all of this to say, is that the algorithm that runs most of these social media apps thrives on engagement, and nothing gets engagement more than, you know, quick hot take style, like quips where it makes it sound like there's you know, like something bad's happening. A little bit of fear mongering, a little bit of you know, hyperbole, and suddenly we have discourse, you know, and I hope that you can see the sparkle emojis that I intend around the word discourse. Suddenly we have discourse about whether or not Disney is trying to own the concept of Loki and is going to punish all the, you know, secret pagans for their beliefs, or, you know, gosh, oh, we're all canceling Llewellyn. Llewellyn's being canceled by TikTok teens. That's not happening. It seems like one person said that they don't like Llewellyn books, and it's okay. That's fine. One person can say that. Come on. One person who I do hope that you'll listen to, though, like that smooth transition, is Dr. Eric Scott. So without any further ado, I present to you my interview with Dr. Eric Scott. Eric Scott, welcome to Inciting Arai, the podcast. I'm so excited for you to be here. How are you today, sir?
I'm pretty good. Really excited to be here too.
Good, good, good. You, well, for folks that don't know you, you're kind of one of those people that sort of operates behind the scenes a little bit of some of the more widely known pagan information entities. So for folks that don't know you specifically, tell folks who you are.
Hi, so I'm Eric Scott. The main thing probably that listeners would know that I work on is the Wild Hunt, which is, I think that we're still allowed to say, the premier pagan and occult news site on the internet. It's been around for a very long time. So I'm part of the editorial team. I handle the weekends, which is opinion, personal columns, and arts and culture coverage. So that is my main thing. I also have a PhD in that was focused on paganism, focused on specifically writing about my experiences as a pagan, and doing some research on what pilgrimage looks like in modern pagan religions.
I really love that. And I think it's absolutely allowed to say sort of like the Wild Hunt is and always will be sort of the foremost center of information for the pagan community. I always sort of liken the Wild Hunt to the New York Times of the pagan community. I always, I mean, even when I've disagreed with articles in the Wild Hunt, I'm like, well, it's still sort of like our paper of record almost. Mm-hmm. Like if it gets on the Wild Hunt, it's sort of worthy of discourse. Even if that discourse is to disagree, it's always a good conversation. It's always a good, healthy disagreement. So thank you for your work there. I do want to talk to you today a little bit about, starting off at least, about you specifically. You're kind of a unicorn in our community, because the one bit of information about you that you left out in your bio there is that you have the rare distinction of having been raised by witches.
Yes. So I was trying to give you an opportunity, an opening. I was raised in a Wiccan coven. Had my entire life. My parents were the high priest and priestess of this group called Coven Pleiades, which came out of a coven called Watersmeet that was founded in the 70s in St. Louis, Missouri, which is where I still live. The coven still going, has been going on since, you know, Pleiades was founded in the 80s. And so I think that I need to keep better track of the calendar on this, but we're past 40 years at this point. And we are still going. The pandemic has been pretty challenging for that, but we just had our first, we had Beltane together for the first time in quite a while, a couple weeks ago. And yeah, so I was sort of raised in the pagan community, which has been a strange experience in a lot of ways, because I think that most pagans and witches don't necessarily recognize this, but paganism is really, the pagan culture is really set up for converts. It's set up with the assumption that you have left another religion and have come into paganism. And so a lot of our baseline narratives, the sort of things that people talk about when they talk about being pagan, assume that you had some kind of problem with Christianity or you know, atheism or whatever your parents were doing, and that led you at some point into witchcraft or into whatever form of paganism you found your way into, which has not been my experience at all. For me, it's just the thing I was raised in.
That's actually, you know, my next question for you, because so much of being a modern pagan seems to be, at least a lot of discourse, or the basis of a lot of discourse, seems to be wrapped up in not just having left Christianity, but almost being actively anti-Christian because of feelings of, oh, I was burned by the church. I mean, I get that, like, you know, the majority of the population here in the United States identifies as some kind of Christian. So statistically speaking, if you change religions in this country, it's very likely that you are changing from Christianity to something else.
Right.
That being said, what's it like not to carry that around? Like, I think I want to ask, just so that I'm clear and the listeners are clear, so we're all defining our terms here. In your lifetime, at least, did your parents convert to paganism, to specifically Wicca, and then become clergy in the faith, or in your whole living memory, you were always a witchy person?
So they were witches before I was born. And so this would have been the early 80s, mm-hmm. is when they would have started practicing Wicca specifically. And then I believe that the legend is that the previous priest and priestess gave that role over to them when they found out that they were pregnant with a friend of mine who, you know, was in the coven, who is 6 months older than me. So I believe that my parents inherited the priest and priestess mantle of our coven while my mother was pregnant with me. I think that timeline works out.
So what's that like then, to grow up in a household where, if you do convert, or if you do have some kind of spiritual exploration, which we're going to talk about, because that's sort of a lot of the focus of your book, of your work and the book you're writing. But if you do have a sense of wanting to sort of explore outside, you're exploring from paganism, from Wicca, from which two other religions, and your basis of comparison is witchcraft, is you know, the magical community. What are some of the things that you hear other people sort of experiencing, or their basis, that you don't have, that you may not have grown up with?
Well, so the main thing is that at least the version that my of Wicca witchcraft that my parents practice, you know, was pretty eclectic. My father was into ceremonial magic before he was into Wicca. And so it was never a single thing for them. And so it was never a single thing for me. So I spent a lot of, you know, I was studying Taoism, for example, when I was 8 or 9. Granted, like we're talking about that I started reading the Tao of Pu and then read the some Xuanzi and some of the Tao Te Ching, but, you know, so not the deepest exploration, but still I was aware that that was a different thing, but that I was something that I was interested in, and I was always encouraged in that. And, you know, that led into my adult life. In my when I was 19 or so, I had my first experience with heathenry at a pagan festival called the Heartland Pagan Festival, which is held at the Gaia Retreat, which is right outside of Kansas City. And so I had this first experience with heathenry there, and I was immediately really taken with it, and started practicing that too, more in an individual capacity. You know, I never joined a heathen kindred or anything like that, and it never crossed my mind that this would be something that I would, you know, that I would give up Wicca for. When I started looking into Taoism when I was young, when I started really seriously looking into heathenry when I was a young adult, these always seemed like, oh, this is another thing. This is another facet of the gem, and you can when I'm with my coven, I'm going to practice this, and this is the way that we do things. When I am at this altar in my house, I'm practicing in this different way. And I remember that some of the first things that I wrote, this was back when I wrote a long time ago for Pathos Pagan, I wrote a series of columns about that first experience with heathenry. And I remember a lot of the comments that I got on that were, you know, you can't call yourself a heathen and also call yourself a witch. Like, you can't be both. You got to pick one. Specifically saying, you know, please don't call yourself heathen or also true. If you're also doing this other thing, you have to pick a lane. And that was just such a foreign concept to me. It never felt like it was completely eclectic, where you just pick and choose and you throw everything into the Wiccan blender. There are distinct sort of traditional styles there, but I never saw any reason why you couldn't try out multiple paths and practice them at the same time.
I do feel like, should I remodel my kitchen, I would be doing it with Wiccan appliances. That's a Wiccan blender, the Lemic toaster. That sounds fun. That's an occult oven. I love all that. That's great. Let's do that. You actually brought up a really good point, the idea of labels. And what's interesting about the modern pagan movement is that it's really young. For all of its trappings of ancient lineage and heritage, mm-hmm. and centuries and thousands, you know, millennia of teachings and beliefs and practices and things like that, it's not it is not an ancient religion. If the most generous I could be is to say that it might go back 100 years, maybe. To have been raised inside of the community since the 80s, that means you've been part of the community for just about half the time it's existed.
I was literally a teenager when Teen Witch came out, so you know that was a weird moment when everyone in my middle school, you know, was talking about Silver Ravenwolf, and I'm standing over there like, yeah,
I bet you were popular.
I've been here for years.
I have been doing this for quite some time. Thanks much. I will happily show you how to call the corners and, right, you know, turn your eyes black and summon Manon and all of that.
Yeah, what you said about the youth of the religion. I mean, I've looked at that really closely in my own sort of family history, because I had this is one of the things that I write about in the book that I'm currently working on, is that the person who founded the Watersmeet Coven, which was the mother coven of Pleiades, who was this British civil engineer named Derek Aldred. He came over he had a job in St. Louis, basically, and he put out I think he put out an ad in one of the local, you know, occult newsletters, saying that he was interested in starting a Wiccan coven. And that's how that all coalesced and started. And he told the people that started the Watersmeet Coven that, you know, he had been friends with Alex Sanders. He said that he, like everyone else, claimed to have been at the Great Cone of Power during World War II.
Wasn't he everybody? That, isn't that like Woodstock? It's like, if you remember being there, were you even there?
he said that we had a book of shadows that supposedly got struck by lightning,
mm-hmm.
and that's why you didn't have it.
I wrote about that for part of the book that's coming out in September, and I love researching that, because like it's a modern myth almost, like, mm-hmm. who was there, what happened, what they did. Like, there's Gardner's account of it in his work, but then there's like everybody else's account of it, and then there's all these other people that have come out over the years that are like, okay, well, I never told anybody, but I was there too, and let me spill the tea, girl, let me tell you. And it's just so funny, because it's like, it's this modern myth that we have almost all, I mean, like, mm-hmm. it's a created story, and I love it. I like zero shade on the modern myth. And the thing is, whether or not it happened at all, I do not care at all. I don't remotely care if it actually happened. I'm obsessed with the story. We all went dancing naked in the woods and, you know, fought off the Nazis with magic. I am here for it. I am here for it. I'm here for it. We need stories like that. We do. I love it. It's great. But I do love how many people have said that they were a part of it. But it's like, but nobody ever told you I was there too. But
yeah, of course I was there too.
Nobody knows. I was in the bushes. I was in the lake. I aimed the cone of power at me. So you have been part of the community for most of the community's existence, or at least, you know, about half of it. And I wonder, because gosh, what a perspective to be able to see firsthand the growth of the community, the exponential explosion of the community, but also probably being in the front seat for a lot of its more maybe problematic discourse, you know, as people have risen and fallen and that kind of thing over the decades. So I wonder just how do you, as an insider, because I know someone that grows up in the church, someone that grows up in another religion, someone that grows up without that. I mean, this is a universal experience to grow up in a faith or in a community and to look around and see that it also has problems. It also has problems. But what was that like growing up in this community and seeing all of that discourse and seeing how it's shaped the community? I mean, because I feel like it shaped this community sort of faster than it shapes other communities, but that's also probably by dint of the fact that our community is so new and so small and it's all sort of constantly being shaped. So what's that been like? How has the community changed for you?
So I think that there's a few things that I would point out for that. I mean, first off is that I was born, the time when I was born was still at the point when pretty much coven-based Wicca was the thing, right?
Mm-hmm. And you were brought up in the middle of the Satanic Panic as well.
Exactly, and mm-hmm. which was a thing. I didn't actually, I knew all the dance steps. I knew that we had full moon every month. I knew that we, and new moon, you know, I knew that, I knew how to participate in ritual from the time that I was a child, but I didn't have a name for it. I didn't actually, the thought process of I belong to a religion called Wicca or I am a pagan didn't really shape in my head until I was 12, because my parents were like, you cannot tell grandma about this. You can't tell, your teachers about this. This is our thing. And you know, which on the one hand, I think that honestly, if you said that, today, immediately people are like, oh, that's a red flag. You're telling your children that there's a thing that you
well,
do.
Well, if you told your 8-year old that today, they would just go on TikTok and tell their 12 million followers, because, you know, that's how many followers right. The average 8-year old I feel like has on social media right now. Like they would just go tell people.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up mostly in the aftermath of the Satanic Panic, still had a some exposure to that, but it definitely changed the way that my parents talked to me about Wicca and about paganism, because they wanted that, you know, they were legitimately afraid that if I started saying, if I, you know, went to school and said, you know, my mom's a witch, that someone was going to call Division of Family Services on us. On the one hand, like that has receded to some extent. There's still a lot, you know, I've always lived in the Midwest. You know, I haven't spent most of my life I've been in Midwestern cities. But I've spent some years living in more rural areas. And, you know, I've certainly met witches out in those areas, you know, in the 2010s who still have a considerable amount of fear about what the consequences would be if they were out. And I'm not completely discounting myself from that. I've never mentioned anything about my religion at my day job.
Oh, for sure. But like, yeah. I feel like there's a lot of people at my day job that don't, they couldn't tell you my last name. I'm like,
yeah.
Like, I feel like I've gotten to the point in my life where I'm like, I don't want to know you. I don't want to know you outside of this office. I don't ever want to see your face ever. I guess I'm old now and cantankerous. And I'm like, I've got all the friends I need. Thank you. Goodbye. I want to ask because, you know, one of the things that you brought up is that, you said, you know, oh, I knew how to participate in ritual before I knew what any of it meant. And that is absolutely an experience that I think is very universal, no matter what faith you grew up in. I remember, you know, growing up and drinking the juice and eating the cracker and doing the communion. And I remember, I mean, you know, you go through the motions. I remember having revival and you're supposed to raise your hands and receive the spirit. And all, I remember going through all of this stuff, Southern Baptist, and, you know, going through the motions and sort of, we were kind of talking before the show, like sometimes kind of looking around and like, okay, I guess I'm going to do that. Or I'm going to say that's what I'm experiencing because sure, I'm not experiencing that, but fine. Everybody else seems to be. So I'm going to go along and I'm going to do it even though I don't understand it, even though I haven't absorbed it, even though it's not like in my body. So I want to talk about, because a lot of times that leads people, or at least in my case, it did, you know, leads to a little bit of critical analysis of starting to ask some questions about the why behind the what. Why are we doing the things that we are doing? Did you ever ask those questions? When did you start asking those questions? And how did you go about finding those answers?
So I think that I started, you know, maybe I was a late bloomer here. You know, I really, a lot of this was when I started to question and started really looking into our practices was right about the time that I left home and you know, and went off to college.
So like everybody else.
So like everybody else, like that, like, I think that I had more of a, because I was aware, I was always aware that I was, in this kind of outsider position. I didn't really want to rebel too much against, you know, what my parents were doing, because I was still always aware that, when I was in, you know, or a teenager that, still the rest of the world was not on my wavelength. And so, you know, I felt pretty defensive about that. I think the main thing was really that when I started doing ritual myself, you know, because I had been, it was this thing where I had been a participant, for 20 years. Then, you know, my parents' generation were starting to get older. Some of them had fallen away from our coven. And just in general, my generation, you know, people who had grown up in the coven, we were starting, you know, we were looking at, how we wanted to, how we would do rituals, you know, if we were the ones in charge. And then of course, eventually our parents are like, sure, fine, do it then, you know, see if you can do better. And you know, it's just one of those things, like in any craft, where you talk a big game and then you have to do it, and then you realize like, oh, there's a lot of thought that goes into this. You know, so that was probably when I really started, especially in terms of ritual structure, that sort of thing. You know, and that has continued over the years, and I've there are more things that I play with and experiment with. In the past couple of years, it had always been in our coven that on the Sabbaths that you write a ritual, like literally write a script, this bespoke, and you never reuse the script. It's always, you know, always a new ritual. And I sort of had gotten fed up with that over the past couple of years, and felt like it was lacking some energy, felt like it was lacking some spontaneity to it. And so I've mostly moved away from that model in the past couple of years. And I don't know, because on the one hand, now I do think that there is that more of that energy, but on the other hand, there was perhaps more thought put into it. when I was actually sitting down and spending a day writing out a ritual and thinking of parts. And of course, you know, the other big thing is that now that we didn't have, well, I probably can't say that categorically, but at the Beltane ritual and at several of the rituals that we've had in the past few years, we have some trans folks who are attending our rituals. And, you know, that's like many Wiccans, I think, in the past few years. You know, you have the whole like, you know, the cop and the knife and symbolism. And you're like, oh, this is, hadn't thought about that before. And so that has been something else that certainly I've been thinking about and experimenting with. I don't know if that's just because I'm a woke millennial, that's something that I've been thinking pretty critically about recently, or if that has, you know, perhaps I wouldn't have the same urge toward that if I hadn't, you know, if I had really wholeheartedly adopted that as a choice when I converted into Wicca. Like, I can see being more defensive of that ritual form if it was something that I deliberately chose as opposed to something that I grew up with.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I was actually just asked about this today in a comment on social media by somebody who said, you know, I've just found the path, I'm gay, I don't really know where I fit here. Because for so long, so many, 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 many years, even to this day, so much of the books that we read and this, you know, the rituals that we find online and that kind of stuff is very Wicca based, and Wicca for a very long time, at least to, you know, the intro layman, you know, dabbler, a love a dabbler, would look at it and say it is very focused on gender and very focused on sex and very focused on fertility. This is a fertility religion. It's very focused on like, anatomical fertility. And that has left a lot of queer practitioners going, listen, I want to show up. I want to be part. I want in. I'm here. I want to do this. I don't know that I like that though. I don't know how I feel about that. And, you know, I mean, when I started this show, it was new and different to have a gay pagan podcaster. I don't want to say that I was the first, but I certainly was one of them. I can't think of anyone else off the top of my head that started before I did, but I'm sure there is somebody. I'm sure somebody will send me a link, but I was certainly one of the first. And I remember getting inundated for the first like 3 years of my show going, can you please talk about what it's like being a gay man in this community? Because how do you relate to that? And I used to say things like, well, I relate to it, you know, through the idea that fertility can be more than just biological procreation, and that it can be my art and my writing and my creativity, et cetera, et cetera. But the older I got, and I guess the more cantankerous that I've gotten, the more kinds of people that I've met, like you're talking about, trans, non-binary people, you know, people along the gender spectrum showing up and saying, I want to be part of this community. You know, I want to be part of these rituals, and saying, but I don't know about that. That's an interesting focus. It is interesting how the larger that our community grows, the more kinds of sticky conversations we have to start asking ourselves.
Right. And so the thing I think about, like about that, this particular situation, and I think that this counts for that, you could point to all sorts of different things in Wicca or paganism, but is that, you know, that focus on you know, on fertility, on sex, on you know, male, female, binary,
gender binary, yeah,
the gender binary, at the time, at the beginning of Wicca, profoundly liberating, right? Yes. Because that's the thing that they're saying, like, look at Christianity, look at you know, traditional conceptions of religion that are sexless, that are not interested in life, that are not interested in the world. We're not that aren't interested in women at all. And here we have this new system that is all about like having sex is good and sacred and women are good and sacred and the world is good and sacred, profoundly liberating. And then, but if you just stay at that point, mm-hmm. of your initial liberation, then eventually, you know, it becomes this box that yes. That then you're stuck in. And if you can't look out and say, oh, there was other stuff that we didn't take that, you know, just wasn't on our radar in the 40s.
In the 40s.
and try and take that into consideration, then that thing that was initially so freeing and so powerful ends up, you know, being another way to imprison yourself.
What's really, and I, you know, this has been part of my last few conversations actually on the show, and something that I guess I'm just really thinking about. And I don't know if it's been part of those conversations because I wrote a book, or if it's just sort of all happening at the same time and it's just a really interesting universal coincidence. But it is interesting how I'm having a lot of conversations lately where people are talking about how stuck we are in our discourse. We seem to really be pining for those like 90s to early 2000s books, writers, mentalities, you know, going back to that and staying there. You know, when I was even talking today on social media about how there's a lot of folks that like read introductory books or new thoughts that have come out in the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years and say, oh, this is an intro, but oh, this is just new. And I'm like, I don't know what you're poo-pooing on. And I don't know why you're like, well, let's continue to recommend the same books from 1993 or 1998 or whatever. I'm like, the community has grown so much since the 90s. And there's so many more new kinds of voices that were not invited to the table in the 80s and 90s that are now not only at the table, but reinventing the way that we have certain kinds of discourse and reinventing pagan thought and furthering discussion. And to discount that is to discount about 15% of the growth in the community, because we haven't been around that long. And if you only look at something from like the 90s, gosh, 15% of the community has happened since then. So much of discourse has happened since then. And so it's interesting, I think, to sort of talk to someone who has seen that arc. I do want to talk about labels, because you brought that up a little bit ago.
The weirdest thing is that people are, you know, people often when I tell them sort of my backstory, they're like, oh wow, like I've been interested in paganism, like what should I read? And I am the worst person to ask, because I never read any of those books. I never read any Wicca 101s, because I had
it. You had a front row seat.
I had a front row seat for it.
What do you say? I'm curious. I want to know. What's your reading list?
I mean, my reading list is pretty accurate.
Bill T, name names right now. I'm gonna tag him on Instagram. No,
well, now I'm worried because you know, a lot of the books, some of the books that I have on my shelf are pretty old and problematic.
But you like, know that, like you can say, well, I read this for this, but X, Y, and Z.
Like the book that my parents gave me when I started looking for this was The Farers, right? Mm. Which lots of issues there. Mm. So I, you know, and also I didn't mention this, but I'm... Just so that your readers, you see where my head is. So your listeners know, I'm a huge lefty. So when people ask me like, oh, well, what book should I read about witchcraft? I'm like, you should read Silvia Federici's Caliban and the Witch. That's where you need to start. You need to have the Marxist analysis of the witchcraft trials. That's where we're beginning.
Love it. Starting you at 401. There's no 101 here. There's no 101 here. You want that? Go back to the kiddie pool. You show up here. You're starting at 401.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, really, I like to tell people to look into some of the, you know, to some of the history and some of the sociology kind of it. So, you know, like, when I had, and granted, I was at, the last time I was asked this, it was by, someone who I knew from grad school. So, but, you know, like I recommended Mario Adler, you know, to get that historical sense. Although, as you point out, increasingly, like the slice of history that it covers is getting more and more out of date.
We just need a new, I mean, I feel like every 10 years or so, we need a new version of Drawing Down the Moon. Though I feel like if somebody were to try to do one of those now, it would be a bloodbath online. Like trying to define certain communities right now. Oh my God.
Woo! Well, I mean, and so this
Witch
is,
Talk
this is one...
would rip you apart if you wrote that book.
and you know, maybe the biggest thing that's happened over the course of my life that I've noticed is that when Margot Adler is writing Drawing Down the Moon, when we talk about the pagan community, we literally meant she drove from community to community and saw what weird stuff they were getting up to.
Yes.
In each of those places.
You used to be able to go and sort of take an in-person census of the pagan community, the five pagans in the whole U.S.
Well, it was like, my parents talked to me about this. If there was a pagan who had written a book, they probably stayed in either my parents' house or one of their, or someone in the coven's house. Like, literally, if they came through St. Louis, like, that was just what happened.
Do you have stories? Nobody's here. Nobody's listening. Who you got stories on? You met Scott Cunningham? What'd he do?
I don't know.
How does he like a cereal? Right,
my main one was that Isaac Bonowitz had been having a feud with someone. I think that he was having a feud with someone in the letters column of Green Egg. I forget who that was.
Feuds with people, like, but, and you had to write in.
You had to write a letter and they had to print it once. And I think it was like the St. Louis pagan pride picnic. Bonowitz was there and my dad came up behind him. And was like, "Hey, Isaac, that guy you're feuding with is here. And he says he's going to kick your ass." And according to dad, Bonowitz just like jumped back and started looking around.
I would pay money for like a BNP, like duke it out. I want everyone that has beef, go fight it. Go ahead. It's fine. Get in a ring, settle it, leave. Like I would pay money for those front row tickets. And y'all can settle it however you want. You want to do a drag show? You want to have a lip sync for your life? Whatever, however you two want to hash it out. It doesn't have to be physical. Y'all do whatever you want. It's fine. We'll do a Project Runway up in here. It's okay. Like, I'm here for it. I want to watch it. That'd be a great YouTube reality show. BNPs with beef. Oh, I want to watch it.
So here's a good example of like how things have changed. My dad, my dad is more interesting than I am. Like just to be totally honest about it. Everyone who knows both of us would agree. So he used to, make like these zines, that he would sell at the local, metaphysical shop. And literally, these were like things that he ran off at Kinko's or something.
Oh, I know a zine. They're making a resurgence too. I know Mara Starling has been like really like, you know, promoting her zine. Like, zines are making a comeback. I love it.
And so like he did interviews with you know, BNPs of the time or some of them anyway. And yeah, I mean,
I feel like people that listen to the show know this, but just in case you all don't know, BNP is big name pagan. Just in case, yeah. Like you don't know that BNP,
which
like,
is a vaguely meant, I think, almost always said with tongue, at least somewhat in cheek,
very tongue in cheek. It's interesting because we're a spiritual community, but we also have like community celebrities.
but those community celebrities are like religious leaders, and it's like this weird confluence of like spiritual leader, teacher, slash you're kind of a celebrity in this weird niche community, and we call you a big name. I don't even think anybody, like nobody, I think very few people under our age even know what that term means now. I said that on like Twitter months ago, and somebody was like, what the hell is that? Is that like a venereal disease? What is that? Like, do I want a BNP? And I'm like, you don't want a BNP. No, you never want a BNP.
And the reason for this is because as a religion, our primary touchstone isn't like a network of churches or temples, but a network of metaphysical shops. I told you I was a lefty. So he used to make these zines, and so he would make like 20 of them. And like, mm-hmm. he was interviewing people for like these 20 zines that you could buy on consignments at the metaphysical shop. And then you look at that, and that was, I think we're talking like 1995, 1997. Mm-hmm. And then you look at what things you have that. And then, you know, 10 years later, not, you know, to plug myself again, you have the Wild Hunt. And you know, 10 years after that, you have the entire social pagan media, blogosphere, yeah, Twitter sphere, yeah. Witch talk on podcast, the horizon.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that has happened there is that on the one hand, it's never been easier to find stuff, right? Like you can find whatever it is you're looking for, you can find someone writing about it, which is great. On the other hand, and you know, this is maybe the story of American life in the past 20 years, but not just pagan life. But at the same time, you don't have that same kind of physical community emphasis that you had when Margot Adler was writing Drawing Down the Moon. And so I often feel, and again, quite ironic for someone who edits a big pagan website, I often feel like in comparison to when I was younger, you know, it's a lot more, the pagan community is a lot more atomized. On the one hand, there's a lot more stuff out there, but having an actual community other than people that we're talking to online, that has changed a lot. And I think that the emphasis, at least on that, has diminished a lot over the course of my life.
Yeah, I am old enough, but mostly I've been on pagan media long enough to have known a time really before social media, just mm-hmm. about. I mean, not, I had Facebook in college, but it was the kind of Facebook where you had to have a .edu email address.
And you couldn't be friends with anyone who wasn't at your college.
No. And I kind of missed that, honestly. I really think that life was a little bit better when that was the case. But I've gotten to see sort of pagan community and pagan growth happen on social media. And like you said, that is a very good thing in a lot of ways, because if there is a topic, there is someone not only talking about it, but there's someone from that community who's talking about it. There's mm-hmm. 100 people from that community talking about it. And like we were talking about earlier, there are people now that aren't even worried about whether or not they're invited to your table. They have built their own table. They are pulling up chairs. There are whole new tables, whole new communities being built. And that is amazing. That's amazing. But on the other hand, like what you said, there's sort of the one thing that we are losing is the idea of sort of vouching for someone as having done their work, as having, you know, sort of been part of community for a long time. Marika Clymer was just on the show, and she teaches Reiki. And she said, you know, instead of just sort of graduating and giving you a certificate, when you graduate my course, in order to graduate, sort of, you have to sort of kind of self-select and say that you're ready to go out. And then the community, your community votes and says, yeah, I think you're ready to go take your own students. Yeah, I think you're ready to go do your own practice. And then we sort of all sign and vouch for you and say, yeah, we saw that person do their work. And we saw that person put in their time. Or conversely, you haven't shown up. You ain't never mm-hmm. been here. I'm not signing your piece of paper. I've never, what's your name? Your face, not familiar to me. I don't know you. No, I'm not vouching for you. Now, there's a lot of problems with that, but there is a sense of community vouching and community acknowledgement that we don't really have anymore. And there's a good thing and bad thing about that. And I'm not saying that that is a sad thing that we are losing it. I certainly don't really have, if you said, you know, I demand firelights bona fides. Well, I guess I'd just show you my podcast. Like, here's what I've been doing since 2009. Other than that, I'm not part of an initiated lineage. I don't have somebody that can say, yes, this is what I've seen firelight do spiritually, you know, for the last 20 years. I don't have that. But I think that there is at least something to be said for that person who's publishing that book. Yes. Yes, that the community that they come from vouches for that person. You know, they have done their work. They have put in their time. They have put in their community.
Well, and the, you know, and this is maybe a problem that is pretty exclusive to me from my position. It's like one of the things that, so I am part of, you know, so my coven is an initiatory religion or tradition, blah. So there's always been this thing of like, you know, there were times when, you know, for various, you know, the things that happen in any kind of small community where there were just things were bad, you know, and there were times at which I'm like, oh, should I go start my, you know, do I want to stick around with this? Like, I could go off and start my own coven. But then it was like, no, I like, this is mine. This is the one that I want to inherit. This is the one that I want to, I want, you know, it's been around for 40 years. It's been around for half of Wicca. So it's the one that I want to keep. And there is this something, there's always this push and pull between, on the one hand, you want to be, you know, bright and innovative and go out and explore new stuff. And on the other hand, at least for me, there is this really compelling thing about inheritance and tradition and knowing that you have, you know, something that has been given to you, and finding the balance there has been one of the, I think, big projects of my adult pagan life, is trying to figure out, how do I, on the one hand, maintain continuity with what has come before in my family tradition, and on the other hand, how do I look at that with a loving and critical eye and say, how do we build on this? How do we make this better? And frankly, how do we make this not stagnant? One of the issues is that when you have people who have been doing things together for 40 years, it's really hard to invite new people in. It's really hard to go up to someone and say, hey, do you want to join this group that has 4 decades of baggage behind it?
I like what you say about a loving and critical eye. I hope that that's what people get out of this show and of the kind of conversations that I have, because, you know, I think that one of the things that I do here on the show, and I try to do in my writing, is to look at our community and to look at the kinds of discourse that we have with a loving but critical eye. And say, I love this, which is why I critique it, because I want it to be better and because I love this community so much. Speaking of a loving and critical eye and sort of your own exploration, let's talk about pilgrimage.
Okay.
So you have written, will be continuing to write pretty extensively about the idea of pilgrimage, sort of about finding your pagan roots, as it were. Where did your lineage come from? Where did your, you know, what is the why behind your what? And you've gone out and taken pilgrimages and sought some of the answers to those questions. So tell me a little bit about what that's like.
Yeah, so pilgrimage really became a focus of mine in the past, about 5 years ago. The thing was that, so in 2014, I got the chance to take a summer language class in Iceland. So this was great. It was 3 weeks in Iceland. And I got to, which I had been obsessed with for, you know, since I could first read an issue of The Mighty Thor when I was, you know, when I was in kindergarten.
I also have been obsessed with The Mighty Thor for a long time, but for probably very different reasons. Go ahead.
And so I went there. I had this whole mythology built up in my head about, you know, Iceland. Yeah, that's where the mythology comes from. That's that was the place where they never really Christianized, right? It was all it was the last place to Christianize, first place to switch back. And of course, you know, I had been a heathen for a couple of years at this point, and so I made contacts with some people in Ásatrúar Feligth, which is the heathen religious organization in Iceland, which is I think that you're contractually obligated to say now the biggest non-Christian religion in Iceland.
Ooh, I don't think I knew that. That's interesting.
And so, you know, while I was over there, I had this really amazing time there. But also, and I got to, like, the big highlight of it was I was there over Midsummer, and they have their big June festival.
Yes, I've seen that movie. Yes,
I made that joke a lot after I saw Midsummer.
I haven't seen that movie because I do not like horror. I have a queasy stomach. I don't do it very well. I can't watch movies like that.
It's like I went to a Nordic country.
What was that spiritual predecessor? Toni Collette, and she's real freaked out and she bursts into flames. Toni Collette.
I don't think I know this one.
Toni Collette. Jesus, I'm just going to keep saying Toni Collette at you until you get it. And it's the babe and the girl is hanging out the window and she hits the thing. And then the grandma's part of a secret cult. And somebody is in their minivan right now screaming at their speakers. And I'm going to just ramble until I figure out that this movie is called, oh my freaking gracious. I'm sorry, this is what this show is right now. Hereditary. Okay, I'm done now.
Hereditary. Okay. Sorry. I was thinking that you were saying that it was its predecessor in the sense that it was like this pagan horror movie. And I'm like,
I mean, it is a pagan horror. No, it is a pagan horror movie.
Oh.
Have you seen Hereditary?
I haven't, no.
Okay. Don't.
Screaming at me.
I am not a horror fan, so I am not the audience for this movie. I did not there's like a secret cult apparently, but you don't know that until like the last 90 seconds of the movie. And I don't know, spoiler alert, it came out like 6 years ago, so whatever at this point, I don't care. 3 years ago, whatever.
But as I was telling Firelight before we started recording, I have never seen a movie. I am always people. Anyone who asks me, you know, oh, have you seen that? And the answer is always no. I have just somehow managed to avoid all movies.
every movie, not one. The only movie he's ever seen is Spawn.
The only movie I've ever seen is F for Fake by Orson Welles, which is great.
The only movie I've ever seen is Step Brothers with Will Ferrell, and I
no.
You're in Iceland. Sorry. Iceland.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. So I'm in Iceland. I get to go to their midsummer ritual or bloat. I get to make friends with a number of people in Ásatrúar Feligth. And the thing that I'm left with as I am coming home from that is, wow, the thing that they're doing is not the same thing I'm doing. The thing that they're doing is really tied to where they are. It's really tied to Iceland and to themselves being Icelanders. And so that just led me to think so much about, and that led me to think about my own sort of, my own role as an American heathen in thinking of Iceland as this sort of imaginary place. This imaginary like heathen holy land where you can go and you meet the Icelanders, and of course the Icelanders are all these, you know, these stereotypes, basically.
And they take you into their longhouse, and they're all wearing the Viking helmets, and
exactly,
you are going to sip from the cup of Freya and all that.
Well, and you know, after I got back, Alsatira Feliath has been in the process of building a building an actual temple in Reykjavik.
This I knew.
They've been working on it for a while now. One of the things that happened shortly after I got back, and I wrote a story about it for the Wild Hunt at the time, was that some American heathens responded to finding out that Alsatira Feliath was building this temple, which again is in downtown Reykjavik. It's not in like any kind of historical site. It's not at Thingvellir, the national park. It's not where any of the sagas take place. That they were like, they so disagreed with the way that Alsatira Feliath does heathenry that they were going to, after the temple was opened, come over and, this was the story, was that they were going to throw, pig's blood on the altar in the new temple because like, it's not a real altar unless it's had animal sacrifice on it. Obviously that's that was a very extreme viewpoint. I'm not trying to claim that that is what, a plurality of American heathens feel, but it certainly did show to me a lot about that. If you're in a different place, things mean different things. And so that got me into really thinking a lot about what it means to pick a place and say, that place seems sacred to me. I'm going to go out of my way to go there because of my religion. And so that's a lot of what my work has concerned over the past 5 years or so, was thinking about that relationship to Iceland and trying to reconcile. I still came away from Iceland absolutely in love with it, absolutely thinking that it was this special, dare I say, magical place that meant a lot to me as a heathen, but also that loving and critical eye that we've been talking about, thinking about like, well, why does it feel that way to me? Why do I want to have that relationship to it? What is it that's there that's not in my backyard? And that also led me the other big pilgrimage that I've taken was to England in 2016. Showing up right after the Brexit election and right after the Trump was elected. So that was a cheery time. In search of Derek Aldred, in search of that the person who founded the Watersmeet Coven that was the mother coven to Coven Pleiades that I grew up in. And basically going through tracing everything I could find about him, because I wanted to find his grave. I wanted to find what happened to him, because he went back to England at some point and everyone lost track because it was before the internet. And over the course of that, that is where I found out where I went and talked to a lot of people in the British pagan community, especially older folks who might have known him, and no one knew him. No one had ever heard of him, which is part of what has led me to my conclusion that he probably went to a few things while he was in England, but the whole thing about, our mother coven, the lineage that he had been a part of before he came to America was probably, like you said, a myth, a tall tale.
I was going to say, can I ask, because we are a new religion. I mean, we're a new faith group. Newer, pretty new. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what we do, what we practice, what we teach, what we learn is cobbled together. Sometimes we say reconstructed, and sometimes that's true, and sometimes that's not. And sometimes it's, we took a line from a thing that we liked and we built a whole thing around it and call it reconstructed. Mm-hmm. And, there's certainly a place for that. And Can I ask you, though, how much does it disillusion you to find out when something is maybe a little bit more tall tale than factual, objective, historical fact?
The weird thing is that, and this is something that I dealt with a lot over, while I was working on that, was that I have like Gerald Gardner make up a lot of stuff. Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't bother me at all. Did Alex Sanders make up a bunch of stuff? Yeah. And that also doesn't bother me. You know, you have all of these hoary old figures from the early days of Wicca and paganism, or, you know, going back further to the, to the beginnings of modern ceremonial magic. And like, sure, I'm totally aware that there's a lot of flimflammery going on there, and that legitimately doesn't bother me at all. Like, I will give you the whole thing about, you know, oh well, like all religions do that, all religions are based on myths, you know, these are ways to manufacture legitimacy, which is sort of necessary when you're starting a new tradition. You have to find something, some kind of ground to hold on to. But when it came to Derek, when it came to this person that that I knew the people he told these stories to, that was a little harder. That was harder to swallow, because Gerald Gardner wasn't lying to me. He wasn't telling these stories to the person who initiated my dad. But this guy was, and that
was a
bit
of that distance there, that distance.
There's
between,
that more direct.
Yeah, you and Gardner versus you and this guy who's at your kitchen table telling you stories.
Right. And, you know, I mean, it's very much, and I think that this is just the most appropriate relationship to compare it to. I mean, it's like when you find out, you know, all of the criminal hooliganery that your grandfather got off to, right? Mm-hmm. It's that same thing where you have that connection and you love that person, even though you've never, you know, in this case, I certainly never met Derek. And I love him and I think of him and like, he's on my altar. I think of him and I think of his wife, Carrie, every day. And at the same time, I'm also like, man, you came over here and told us a bunch of stuff. Like, mm-hmm. and because you came over here and made a bunch of things up, that's my entire life. Mm-hmm. That is the entire trajectory of my life. It comes out of the fact that you made some stuff up. And that's a difficult thing to reconcile, because you want to think that your life should be based in absolute truth, but of course no one's life is. Everyone's life is built on lies.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a lot of things, but the image that comes to mind most vividly is, do you ever see Avatar: The Last Airbender, the show, not that terrible movie?
A couple of episodes.
Okay, so there's an episode where Aang, the current Avatar, mm-hmm. He was, the conceit of the show is that, you know, he was like 11 or 12, something like that. You know, he was a burgeoning Avatar, you know, the spiritual Avatar of, you know, the energy of the earth or whatever. It's changed in later seasons, right. But whatever, it's, Aang is, you know, the guy. The chosen one, frozen in an icicle for 100 years, comes back, and in one of the episodes he deals with two different communities of people that hate each other because of something that the other community allegedly mm-hmm. did, oddly enough, like 100 years ago. And you know, they say, oh, this guy stole this from us and took it over here. And no, that guy stole this from, it was actually the other way around. They stole it from us and they took it over here. And Aang says, you know, I was actually there And you guys are misinterpreting all of this. This was a game. And the thing that you all were saying was stolen was the ball, and the like great like pillars were like just the goalposts. And y'all have taken this story and turned it into this whole mess of stuff. And it's so interesting because these entire communities have like built up these beliefs about other people, mm-hmm. and built up, you know, this entire ideology and identity based off something that two people went back to their communities and told a little bit of a fib about, and that fib grew and grew and grew. And I think that there's probably a lot of better examples of that, but in our community, there are a lot of things that when you poke at them just a bit too hard, they start falling apart objectively. Mm-hmm. But somebody like me comes in and says, yes, okay, we poked the stick. And the thing fell apart, and we realized that it wasn't actually this. It was this other thing, or maybe it was never really anything at all. But are we all still getting something out of it? Is there still something that we can get out of it? Yes. Yes, there is. And that's valuable. I think that is incredibly valuable. And I'm so glad to hear that you, a lifelong pagan, somebody raised by witches, says, you know what? I have to contend with the fact that a lot of what I practiced is based on somebody's stuff that they largely made up.
You know, learning to live with those stories and make use of them, you know, the main thing that I think that a lot of people, especially people outside of paganism, when they, you know, when they have those gotcha moments, when they're like, oh, you know, that didn't really happen that way. That the feeling there is that finding out that some of your stories are more mythological than factual is a reason to, you know, to throw the stories away. Mm. And I, you know, but to throw that away would be to throw away, you know, my whole life. Mm. And that's real. That part I know and can verify. So then it's more about, it becomes more about, well, what do you do with that? What do you do with what you've been given? And how do you use that to build the, you know, to build the stories that the people who come after you are going to inherit?
I love that, because, you know, that idea of what do you do with what you've been given, and how do you build the stories for the people after you? Because I think that it's important, because right now we're in a very interesting time where there is a lot of social media, there's a lot of discourse, there are a lot of people doing a lot of poking of a lot of sticks at a lot of things. And still, I think there's a space to say, okay, so this objectively is not what we were told it was. Mm-hmm. This objectively was maybe something else, or maybe this didn't even happen. You know, maybe this stone here doesn't do this, or maybe this herb doesn't do that, or maybe, you know, all of this came out of some drunken night in the back of a car, or somebody got real high and said some cool stuff and they wrote it down and built some stuff out of it.
Or even more difficult, like maybe this thing that we've been told about and that we've used for a long time, Maybe that has some homophobia in it that we didn't think about. Maybe there's some transphobia. Maybe we stole this from indigenous people and never really thought it through.
Maybe we just included the use of white sage for 40 years inside of pagan literature, never really thought about it and poked at it, and then in the last 5 years, suddenly we're all told, oh, you shouldn't have been doing that this whole time, and now we're like, what does that mean? What do we do? It's like, it's you just change. You just do different things now. You just grow with that information. You roll with it. Mm-hmm. You don't let it completely unravel your attraction to magic, your attraction to the mystical, your attraction to the divine. That can still exist alongside learning that maybe not everything you were told was true.
Yep.
I mean, you can still believe in magic and know that, I don't know, Santa Claus didn't actually deliver your presents on Christmas Eve for our kids.
Let's keep our head.
Maybe the Easter Bunny does not deliver those chocolate eggs.
Okay, I don't. this conversation has gone and some has taken a dark turn, and I'm not.
Maybe
sure.
Befana does not, sure not fly. Like. Maybe Befana does not fly down your chimney and clean your house and leave you oranges.
Then who leaves the oranges, Firelight? Who leaves the oranges then?
It's Geraldine, okay? Geraldine walks around to everybody's house. Fucking oranges. She's still an immortal being. She's just not this, like, pretty Christmas witch. She's Geraldine. She walks around with her sack of oranges. Obviously. Can I ask, you know, you brought it up. There's been a lot of tough truths that the community has had to accept about transphobia and homophobia and appropriated practices and contending with internalized white supremacy, internalized homophobia, internalized misogyny, even in a community that, like you said, at one time was revolutionizing what spiritual teaching could be by, you know, goddess worship and centering the divine feminine. We have had to do a lot of sort of self-analysis of some of the less good bits about our community. One of those bits is in the heathen community. How has it been to reconcile being inside the heathen community and getting something of value out of it and contending with the harm that a lot of its most visible organizations almost seem to be purposefully attempting to do?
Yeah, I mean, and to be honest, this is one of the reasons why I've never joined a heathen organization. I've never
So you're a fake heathen, then, is what you're saying. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Scott, right here on Unsiding Around? You are a fake heathen. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, you got me.
You didn't sign the dotted. You didn't sign up. You're not part of the union.
I'm not paying my dues. And, you know,
you're not part of the union. You're out of here, Butter. Buster. Butter. There you go. Your name Butter. Is Butter now.
So, yeah, I mean, this is so. The thing is that, you know, if you look at me, I am a white guy with a beard, with long hair, who wears a Thor's hammer every day. I'm always really cognizant of the fact that, like, if someone sees me and sees my Thor's hammer and knows what that means, that they may not assume that I am on the side of the angels. That's, you know, I think about that a lot. And there's been a lot of people every couple of years, it's more like every couple of months, you know, you get
these
something
days,
where,
yeah.
where some group of open, openly racist, white supremacist heathens, or not even necessarily heathens, just like people on the far right who start using some kind of Norse or heathen imagery. And then there's this whole thing of like, well, that's another thing we've lost. Like, that's another thing that has that we can't use anymore. And I've always tried to take the opposite approach, that like it's really important to hold on to and to maintain and to fight back against that kind of use of imagery. And I don't. We had a whole. Big column by Carl Siegfried a couple months ago about why appropriation is perhaps not the right word for this. But the thing is that symbols mean what we tell ourselves they mean. Mm-hmm. And that's not like an individual thing, that's a cultural thing. Thor's hammer means whatever we collectively decide it means. And so then it's really important to, if you believe that it should not stand for white supremacy, if it should not stand for racism, then it's really important to fight for that meaning. It's really important to fight against the idea that that's what it stands for. And it's hard and sometimes exhausting because it there is frequently, even when you don't immediately run into racist heathens, I would say that more of the time it's the fact that you can never be, that it feels like you're never sure. You run into someone and you see that they have a Thor's hammer and you would like to think like, oh, cool. Like we're right on. This is a person who, this person is someone who I should get to know. But you always have, but then it, instead of having that moment of joy and elation at finding another member of this small, small community, instead there is this moment of dread where you're like, okay, let's roll the dice here and see how it goes. And most of the time I found that it's not that, you know, you don't run into the person that you run into with a Thor's hammer is not, is not a white supremacist, but there's enough that are that it is hard to, that it feels like you never leave your guard down about it.
There's enough that are, and there's just something about their loudness that seems to continue to attract people to that minority. But I think focusing on just white supremacy and heathenism and heathenry ignores the imminent, with an A, the implicit white supremacy that just sort of exists in all things.
Yeah.
It exists in all of paganism. It exists in all of witchcraft. It exists in all of it. And there's white supremacy in all of it. And excising that is a painful, difficult thing, because then we first have to admit that maybe some of the stuff we've been doing has contributed to it, whether or not we ourselves consider ourselves white supremacists. I think the best thing that a white ally can do is say, yup, I've got that deep down in me. And it's going to take the rest of my life to unlearn it. But boy, howdy, am I sure going to try. And I'm going to mess up. And if I mess up, tell me, and I'm just going to know better and do better. And if I fuck up majorly, I deserve to be called on that. And I'm going to just do better. I'm going to listen. I'm going to grow and I'm going to learn.
Yeah,
go ahead.
We always have to remember that, you know, Gardner himself was a colonial administrator. Like that was his job. Mm-hmm. If you think that that's not in, no matter how far removed we might think we are from that, you know, the issue of it not being that long ago cuts both ways. And so, you know, it is, you know, the danger, I think, is that, again, we think that that means that we need to throw everything out, that like the fact that Gardner was, to, you know, to be blunt, was literally a colonial functionary, means that then, you know, oh, well, the whole thing is rotten. It's a fruit of the poison tree.
Sure.
But and that I don't think that's true at all.
Right. This isn't a court of law. This is not a court of law. Just because you obtained some knowledge through dubious means. I mean, you know, if we had to throw it all out, then, gosh, I hate to tell you a lot about like science and how we know a lot about like surgery and the body and medicine and stuff. Like, oh boy, if we have to throw it all out because it came out of problematic sources, oh, you're just going to drown. You ever start drowning in a pool, you're just going to drown. Because I hate to tell you about how we know about the science of drowning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's just so many things that came from Nazi scientists or just came from people that were maybe doing dubious things with homeless people or prostitutes or, you know, all sorts of stuff. And it doesn't mean that we don't have good information now, but if you start throwing everything out just because you poked at it and you found out some stuff that's sticky, you just have to deal with the fact that you have something, you have knowledge, you have something that's still worth something here, but you still have to acknowledge where it came from. And yeah, I mean, it would be parts of how you use that knowledge are then treated differently.
It would be easier to just be able to throw it all out. But, you know, the hard work is figuring out how to move forward with it.
Gosh, thank you so much. I know that we're over time here. So I want to thank you so much for spending this time with me, Dr. Eric Scott, PhD, weekend editor at The Wild Hunt. If folks want to get a little bit more of you or interact with you online, how do they do that?
So first off, please just visit wildhunt.org. That is, we post every day, news during the week, and then the stuff I work on, columns, opinion, and arts and culture on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then if you're interested in keeping up with me or seeing my thoughts on,
all the movies, all your film reviews.
All my film reviews, indeed. But if you're interested in seeing me mostly talk about paganism and left politics, I'm on Twitter at Eric O. Scott, and on Facebook at eric.o.scott.writer.
I love following people where at any given time you could get some opinions about a pagan ritual you just attended. You could get some opinions about the inner workings of unions. You could get some opinions about the current like gun laws in Kentucky or something. Like, I just love accounts like you're that are just like, you just don't know what you're gonna get today, baby.
I mean, I only have 800 followers on Twitter, so like, I'm still at that comfortable level where I can tweet about whatever.
Nothing
whatever
that
I want
say matters. Oh, I miss that. Fine. When I had like, less than 500 followers, it's like nothing I say matters. I can say whatever I want. I love it.
So, if my follower count ever blows up, then I'll have to start being responsible with it. But
just change my whole Twitter. I'm just going to just delete the whole thing, burn it all. I'm now Nice Eric Scott. I am at Nice Eric Scott. Follow me there. Goodbye. Okay, Dr. Eric Scott, thank you so much for spending some time today here on Inciting a Riot. You have a good rest of your day.
It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, rioters, that is going to do it here for us today. Episode 172, Inciting a Pilgrim Riot. Once again, I would like to thank my very special guest, Dr. Eric Scott of The Wild Hunt. Please do go follow him on social media. He is a treasure. If you like this show and you would like to support it, there are a number of ways to do that. You can consider liking and sharing it on social media. Word of mouth really helps to get the show out. You can also rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download shows and leave a review. Literally any review. positive, please. But literally any review helps bump the show up in the algorithm and gets it into the ears and feeds of the folks that might like to hear shows like this. You can also help keep the show free and producing on a regular basis by chipping in $1 a month or whatever you can over on my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content. In the case of this episode, patrons received nearly about half an hour of additional content, as well as archived episodes. If you're new to the show and you're wondering what happened to the first 99 episodes, they're on Patreon. A private Discord server where we can chat and let our hair down a little bit, and monthly chats with special guests. This month's guest, June's special guest was Josephine Winter, the author of Fire Magic, and an upcoming guest here on The Riot. You can also, if you'd like to donate a little bit of money, but you don't want to do it on a monthly basis, you can buy me a coffee. Both of those links are in the show notes. You can also pre-order my book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, at bit.ly/dabblersguide. The D&G are capitalized because that's how Bitly works. Anyways, thank you all so much for tuning into the show. If you would like to find me directly, I am pretty much at Inciting a Riot on all forms of
social media, TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Find Inciting a Riot wherever you are on social media. If you'd like to email the show about this show or any other, you can do that at Firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. And of course, show notes and occasional blog posts are on the website at incitingariot.com. Thank you all so much for tuning in to the show. I appreciate it so much more than you could possibly imagine. I'm going to leave you though, but as always, I will leave you with love and light, Firelight.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.